This is tape two, morning of October the 5th. You were asking questions about Adams, Dave.
Well, the thing we're trying to get at, he had some encounter with what they call the midnight appointment of judges. He appointed a great many judges during his administration.
Well, I'm informed that the clerical help at the White House was only one man, and they didn't have a chance to get these things ready at the proper time, and so in order to get them ready, they sent them to the Congress after midnight. And that's what caused the lawsuit between called Marbury versus Madison. Madison, afterwards as Secretary of State, and refused to sign the commissions. I think eventually he was forced to sign the commissions.
But he's supposed to have been up all night signing these commissions one night on...
That was the reason, because they didn't have the clerical help available to get those commissions ready. So when they were ready, Adams stayed there and signed the commissions and then left the White House so he wouldn't have to ride with Jefferson to the inauguration.
But the this was all repealed during Jefferson's administration later, was it not?
They finally arranged things so the president had some clerical help, which would help him to get the papers ready for the Congress, as they should have been. You see, Washington had all the help he needed because he was a very rich man. And while he didn't take any salary from the as President of the United States, he had all the clerical help he needed because he paid them himself. Adams was not the rich man that Washington was.
And in those days, the president paid his own help? The
president paid his own help. He only had one clerk, as I understand it. But of course, that's been remedied since. Now he has a host of clerks.
All in all, how would you rate President Adams as the second president of the United States?
Well, I'd rate him not as a great president. I think he would rate along with Martin Van Buren and with Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan as just a president of the United States. We had a modern one, his name was Coolidge, along in the same class.
Well, there were many men who were nominated for the presidency along with Adams during that particular period. Washington and Washington's brother was nominated. They had all kinds of people, didn't they?
Well, I don't remember about that, but I know that Washington's policy was to have Adams succeeding because he thought very highly of Adams. Adams had been with him in the Continental Congress at... wrote the Constitution, and Adams had been the representative of the Continental Congress abroad, and Washington thought very highly of him. I think anybody that Washington was for would have been nominated for President of the United States at that time. Hamilton was anxious to be a candidate, but Hamilton's background was not exactly one that would stand the light of day. He was not able to find out who his father was when he came to the United States, and that was no reflection on Hamilton. That wasn't his fault. But then they were very much afraid in those very strongly religious days that that would have some bad effect on him. So the Congress at that time nominated the presidents, and the Congress nominated John Adams.
Hamilton tried to throw his influence to Pinckney. Well, why would he want to do that?
I don't have any idea why Hamilton was not for Adams, but Pinckney was a South Carolina man of high standing, who had been a member of the Continental Congress and with whom Hamilton was very well acquainted, and I have an idea it was a matter of friendship more than anything else. There wasn't any difference in the policy feeling of Pinckney and John Adams.
Well, did the country thrive under the presidency of Adams, or was it just a holding action? Were we making any progress as a result of it?
Oh, I think we were, because the country couldn't help but grow. It was in its infancy, and I think the country under natural conditions just naturally grew to some extent. Of course, when Jefferson became president, the situation in Europe was such that Napoleon was very anxious to put the British out of commission. And when he took over the Spanish monarchy, he obtained the whole western part of the United States between the western boundary of Colorado and the Mississippi River, known as the Louisiana Purchase to us. And in order to offset the British control of world affairs, he sold that to the United States, and that's how that came about.
Mr. President, how would you characterize that period in which Adams was president? Because XYZ affair arose, and when Adams took office, there were demands for a declaration of war against France, and Adams sent a commission over to see if they couldn't settle with the French. And as I understand it, Talleyrand, that great diplomat, demanded a bribe before he would receive or talk to. What sort of period was that?
It was a very, very, very touchy period in the history of the world. That was the time when Britain and France were struggling for control of the whole world at that time. And Napoleon had succeeded in obtaining control of the continent of Europe, and Britain had succeeded in maintaining the control of the seas. And so Napoleon found it impossible to maintain a colonial program after the British became the controllers of the seas, and that it was a very, very difficult time. We've always gone through those difficult times, and every period of the history of the country we've had those times to face. We have them right now in almost the same circumstances.
Well, did President Adams leave anything enduring upon the history or the evolution of the United States as a nation?
Only upon the federal judges, which caused the lawsuit called Marbury versus Madison. If you read the background of that lawsuit, you'll see what Adams left.
Anybody in his cabinet who was particularly distinguished?
I don't think so.
Well, he had John Marshall there, Secretary of State, didn't he, at first?
Yes, John Marshall was Secretary of State, and he's the fellow that caused the appointment of these judges. He was a very, very right-wing believer, John Marshall was, and was afterwards made the Chief Justice of the United States, and made several great decisions during the period he held that office. I think he held it until 1835. If I'm not mistaken.
Then there's nothing during the administration of Adams that either distinguished him or contributed to the growth and development of the United States.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Of course, that's a personal opinion.
Would it have made any difference if someone else had been elected to the presidency at that time?
Well, when you contemplate those things, you never can tell. That's a hypothetical question that can't be answered. You never can tell what anybody else would have done as President of the United States until he's there and has a chance to act. And therefore, you can't answer a question like that.
Well, wasn't it during his administration that this Alien and Sedition Act aroused all this dispute?
Yes, the Alien Sedition Act. The Alien and Sedition Acts were passed and were really unconstitutional. I think they were repealed in the Jefferson administration, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he associated the 11th Amendment, certain limitations on federal courts.
Well, the idea, I imagine, and I think of the 11th Amendment, was to make the courts comply with free government, which they had not done under the Alien and Sedition Laws.
Now, what about this one period there where President Adams recalled his son, John Quincy Adams, who was minister or ambassador to Prussia?
Yes, I think it was Prussia. He was also in Russia, too.
And he was trying to save him from being dismissed by his successor, Thomas Jefferson, or
I think
it was on grounds of nepotism?
I don't know why that was, but I don't think Jefferson had any idea of dismissing John Quincy Adams on that account, because Jefferson and John Quincy Adams were not unfriendly. I think Jefferson appointed him to places of foreign service while he was president of the United States.
Just as an outline, what did a president do in those days? How did he function?
Well, he functioned for a country that had about three million and a half people in it, in the same manner that the president functions now with 180 million. Only there were not so many things to be done. In those days, the state governments were almost independent for the simple reason that communication were such that a state government had to act in the interest of that state. And eventually the federal government grew to the point where the coordination between the state governments and the federal government made it much more difficult for a president to act as president, although his duties were exactly the same as they were under the first presidents.
Did the president stay on the job the year around? Was there any?
No, I don't think he did. I don't think the president ever stayed on the job the year around until War of 1812, when Madison had to stay on the job all the time. The same thing was true in the Mexican War, and it was also true in the Civil War in the 1860s, the first 1860s, from 1861 to 65. And it was also true in the First World War. But in between, in those periods in between, the president usually stayed in Washington during the period of the sessions of Congress. Then he went off on a vacation, didn't come back until Congress met again, when he had to send a message to them on the State of the Union.
Well, in that connection, Washington did become the capital during the Adams administration.
Yes.
And he was the first to occupy the White House.
John Adams was the first man to occupy the White House. And one of the things that Washington did while he was President of the United States, he traveled by stagecoach and horseback to every colony of 13 that made up the United States. And he spent a great deal of his time, when the Congress was not in session, familiarizing the people with the government of the United States from the presidential viewpoint. He went from Georgia to Massachusetts and back time and again while he was president. And that's the way he spent most of his time when he was not sending messages to the Congress.
He did that by lectures or meetings, or how did he talk?
Did it by
people?
Meetings. He talked to people and explained things. He was not a great orator, but he was able to put his thoughts across to various meetings so people could understand what he was talking about. And I think he did as much as any other person of that period to knit the country together as the United States of America. That's what makes him one of the great, great presidents.
Do you have some idea of what was a typical day in the life of a president in those days? What did he do from the time he got into the office?
Well, it's difficult. It's a very difficult thing to do because conditions were entirely different. In the days up until the railroads came along, he spent a great deal of his time traveling back and forth from his home to the capital of the United States, and that consumed an immense amount of time. Of course, he stopped on the road and talked to people, and when you go across the eastern part of the United States, the old colonies, you'll find places where this president and that president slept in his hotel on his way to the capital of the United States, whether it was New York, Philadelphia, or Washington.
Well, who would come to see him? What were the appointments like?
Well, the congressmen were mostly interested in the appointments. They're the ones who were the president's chief pests when it came to filling jobs under the government. And they had no civil service in those days, and it was a very difficult matter. The president usually made his own appointments in all lines that affected the government of the United States. And he made those appointments usually in the departments on the recommendation of the secretary of that department, Secretary of State, Secretary of War, Secretary of the Treasury, the Attorney General. But after old Garfield was shot because some fellow didn't get the job he thought he ought to have, why, they commenced working on a civil service program which would make a continuing force at work for the government right straight along, regardless of which president was elected. And it's worked very satisfactorily.
This is the end of tape 2, October 5th. The morning of October the 5th, Mr. President. Dave.
Well, one more question about calendar or the life of a president in those days. It was fairly unhurried and easy-paced, and there were no really great pressures on him, excepting, as what you said, patronage demands on him.
Well, yes, but there were other pressures on him because of the rivalry between the French and the British for the control of the war. There were times when the president had difficulty maintaining the frontiers of the United States with regard to these two great powers, and he had difficulties of that sort. And then there were other times when the president's principal job was a social one. He had receptions and levees and things of that kind at the capital of the United States in New York and Philadelphia, and my address was moved to Washington, and there was much time spent in social affairs of the people who lived in the capital, principally with the Congress and with the people who held public office and with the governors and people who represented the states and who had interests in the program of the federal government.
Was there much lobbying going on in those days?
Just as much as it always has been, only not on quite such a great scale because there weren't so many people to be lobbied for.
But the president, by and large, was not too involved in any of the activities that had to do with what was going on before Congress.
Well, nearly all the presidents took a very great interest in what was going on in the Congress and was in close touch with the Congress all the time. He had to be if he was going to get a program put over. And the president, of course, was the center of a great deal of lobbying in those days.
Now, Mr. President, you mentioned before a figure of 3 million. The population was about 5 million, wasn't it?
3.5, I think, when the Constitution was organized, and of course it grew to about 5 million in a very short time.
In
Adams' administration, I imagine it goes up as far as 5.5.
So that, after all, that's about as big as the city of New York is today.
Well, it's not nearly as big as the city of New York is today. New York's got about 7.5 million people in it.
Yes, but the ramifications of power were much more important because, as you say, the frontiers were watched, Europe was at a war, and...
That's true. And the French were still on the continent to some extent, especially after Napoleon obtained control of Louisiana. That was true.
Well, the president at that time had more leisure to write letters, composing them by hand, and I presume he had more leisure to do whatever thinking was necessary. Do you think it has been a loss since the president hasn't got that leisure to do that?
Well, of course, at the present time, the president has so much to do that doesn't seem ever any time to get it done, but he can manage to do it. In the days we're talking about, in the time of Washington, Adams, Jefferson, all the way up to Grover Cleveland, the president was in the habit of writing his messages to the Congress in long hand. And in some instances, we have records of documents of most vital importance. For instance, the document that's called the Monroe Doctrine, the message on the situation in the Western Hemisphere, was written in long hand and sent to the Congress. We have a copy of it here in the library, or had the original here in the library, but they had to take it back to Washington.
Well, now, a president in those days had no special prerogatives that were provided for him in any of the documents. He had to assume a certain role that was not explicitly described in the Constitution.
Well, the four important jobs of the President of the United States are prescribed in the Constitution of the United States. And in carrying out those four roles, he was a very busy man, and most of the presidents were very jealous of their prerogatives as the chief executive of the United States under the Constitution. And of course, there have been other additions to the situation. At that time, the president had about five jobs, four of them set out in the Constitution. The other was his social state as head of the nation. And then when the political parties came along, he became the head of his political party. That was the sixth job under which he worked. But all the presidents were exceedingly jealous of their prerogatives as the chief executive of the United States. I don't think any of them were willing to forego any of their rights as the head of the nation.
Well, was the president challenged, say, during the Washington or the Adams administration with regard to his
prerogatives? I don't think Washington was ever challenged with regard to his prerogatives, although he was roundly abused when he enforced the Constitution in the Whiskey Rebellion. And Adams and the passage of the Alien and Sedition Laws felt that the President had been abused when he should not have been, and that is the reason for those two laws. Every President's had his troubles along the same lines.
Well, to sum up the Adams administration, there was nothing that he had proposed or advocated for the country at that time that made him stand out as a great president.
I haven't been able to discover it. It may come to light later on, but I haven't been able to discover it so far.
Well, with that, can we go on to the third president, Thomas Jefferson, and how do you rate him as a president?
Well, Thomas Jefferson was one of the five or six great presidents. George Washington, of course, was the first great president. I think Jefferson was the second man who became a great president of the United States for the simple reason that he had very great difficulty when he was elected. If you remember, Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson got an equal number of votes in the Electoral College, and the matter had to be thrown into the House of Representatives. Jefferson was finally elected. And then Aaron Burr decided he'd organize an empire of his own in the Southwest, and was finally tried by treason for doing that very thing, and would have been convicted had it not been that John Marshall, as Chief Justice, prevented that event from taking place. And then Aaron Burr, as you remember, got into a controversy with Alexander Hamilton and killed him, and that ended Burr's usefulness as a public man in the United States of America. It was a terrible thing that duel where Hamilton was killed, because Hamilton was one of the great men of his period. And Burr had a chance to be, but he had tremendous ambitions. I don't know what he'd have done had he been elected and Jefferson had not been. The idea that he would have done everything he possibly could to make the president an absolute monarch. That's what I thought in studying this thing. Well, Jefferson became the president of the United States and set up a government and organized a party that has existed until today. Jefferson's always pointed out as the man who was anxious that the ordinary, common, everyday man should have a hand in his government, the same as the fellow who had all the money in the world. And that's been a controversy, and has been a controversy that has been supported by the Democratic Party for the common people ever since Jefferson's time.
What is your impression of Jefferson as a person? How would you describe
him? Well, in reading the correspondence between Jefferson and Adams, and reading a great many of Jefferson's documents which he left, he was a human being just like all the rest of us. And his interests were various and covered nearly every front that you can think of. As governor of Virginia, he made the law on the freedom of religion in the state of Virginia. I don't believe Virginia would pass that law now, but in that day they did pass it, and Jefferson put it into effect. That was before the Constitution of the United States was adopted, and part of that law of Jefferson's was included in that. As President of the United States, he did a great many things for the welfare and benefit of the ordinary citizen. His interests were scientific, historical, and any subject you want to mention, you find an article somewhere in Jefferson's papers that covers that very situation. He was one of the brainiest men of his time in any line you want to take up: engineering, agriculture, government, anything else you want to name. Jefferson had an interest in that subject.
Even art and drawing.
Art and drawing and everything of the kind, and he was also a fiddler. He was interested in music. He was a very good violinist, Jefferson was.
As good as you're a pianist?
No. Well, he wouldn't have to be very good to do that.
What sort of music was he interested in, as you recall?
He was interested in the music of the day that we call classical now.
Yes.
He liked good music and was very much interested in it. And in his house back there at Monticello, they have his stand on which he, before which he stood when he was practicing on his violin.
Do you have any idea whether music was part of his habit while he was president?
I don't have any historical data on that subject. I think that he spent most of his time, that he was not in Washington, at his home, because he was building this house they call Monticello at that time, and finally got it finished. And most of his interests were centered at his home, and he spent the time in Washington only when it was necessary for him to be there.
When Now, you were describing Thomas Jefferson as a man of many, many skills and many talents and a considerable genius.
That's right. He was interested in everything that was going on. He brought a great many plants from Europe and started them on the agricultural program for the United States. And he had all sorts of gadgets in his home at Monticello. He had a wind gauge on his roof, which was registered down in the front hall of his mansion. He also had his bed fixed so he could pull it up by ropes out of the way when he wanted to make a connection between his dressing room and the room next to it. He also had all sorts of things. In fact, he built a cart in which he rode back and forth to Washington with special springs on it, so it made it easy riding. That cart is still there in his home. And you find that he had a hand in the conservation program, which he really started to save the soil of the great state of Virginia and keep it all from washing into the Atlantic Ocean. He didn't have much luck in carrying it out because the generations that followed him were not interested in it. That's the reason Virginia's soil is not so rich as it was in Jefferson's time.
Now, he also had something to do with the monetary system of our setup.
Yes, he made it a decimal system. He made the dollar, a tenth part of a dollar, a dime, and the penny that was the hundredth part of a dollar, a 1 cent piece, they called it. Proper name for it. And of course the smaller coins were half dollars and quarter dollars. And it made it a much easier approach than the British pound sterling, which had all sorts of arrangements that were difficult to remember and hard to tell anything about. The British still sticking to that same plan. And it's always hard to tell what you have in English money when you try to translate it into American money. He also did his level best to get the metric system of weights and measures adopted in this country, but that was never done.
This is the end of tape 3, October the 5th.
My goodness.